Okay. Yeah, okay. It was Bill Haynes that was at Gresham with me in 58, and he went to the 111 program very early. He was part of the initial cadre that went to the 111 program, and he would call me occasionally encouraging me to also get in the 111 program, and he was telling me about the wonderful avionics and all that good stuff about the airplane. And the one question that he would hedge on, though, when I would ask him, I'd say, that's wonderful, now tell me which airplane's more fun to fly. And then he'd go back to, well, but you got to appreciate the avionics, this airplane's so smart, blah blah blah. And I said, which airplane's more fun to fly, Haynes? And well, I guess maybe the Hustler. And I said, thank you.
Now, John, what was he so crowing about in the avionics package? Can you remember any piece of it?
Primarily the TFR, the train following radar.
And
that was the big thing in the 111. We had train following radar in the Buff, but it was in its early years and not that great. I mean, it was something I didn't trust very far. And course,
what was its function, John? Can you
The train following radar, the function was to be able to take you down as low as possible to the ground when you were ingressing a target, and to get you down on the deck, even in hilly terrain. And what it would do is it would contour fly you. It would tell you when there was a little hill or something in front of you, so you'd stay low until just the last minute, then you'd pop up over that hill, and then back down again. Of course, the purpose of this was to evade the radars,
right. So
that they could see you as you were coming in. As I say, back in the 60s, they came out with this train avoidance radar. That's what they called it in the Buff. And the train avoidance was the precursor of the TFR in the 111, the train following radar. But in the early days, as you might expect, it had some glitches, and wasn't something you'd really trust to take you down there. But just to give you an example, one of the stories that Haynes told me about the TFR and the 111, he said one of the most difficult things was the first night low-level mission. He said and this thing was tied into the autopilot. So and that airplane, he said, it takes you down quickly, because the idea is to get you down low as quickly as possible so that you're not going to be picked up by radar. So he said this airplane really screams down, and he said it's just rushing down to the ground. And he said it was all I could do to keep my hands off the stick, to keep from overriding the autopilot. And he said it just waits until the last second, then it levels you out. And he said, and that puppy flies you, and it'll actually fly you just... And he said, flying it in daylight when you can look out and see what it's doing, he said, it's just flying you as close as it can to all these hills and valleys and everything else, taking advantage of the terrain to keep you as low as possible. So it was quite a thing, and that was one of the two biggest things about the 111 as compared to the B-58 was that, and we didn't have that package in the B-58, and the swing wing, the movable wing, which gave him more loiter time and also gave him the ability to operate out of short fields, although the SAC 111s never were used on short fields. They operated out of the same runways that we used all the time. But it was a capability that they had that we did not have.
John, what is loiter time?
The ability to just fly around and spend time in the air. See, by putting those wings out, they could slow down and be very fuel efficient. So those were two of the advantages of the airplane. But the other thing, and back to Altus, there was a similar story that I had with this guy, and I don't know if I told you about that or not, the SR-71 pilot.
Mm-mm.
Anyway, Darrell Cobb, he and I were together. Now, this is going back to Altus in the B-52 days.
Uh-huh.
And he and I both applied for the SR-71 at the same time, and what we heard back was... long story short, it cut through the military language was, don't call us, we'll call you. But essentially what the response was that due to the high number of requests and applications and the small number of slots, because there weren't very many SR-71 aircraft, said, we'll put you on the list. You're both qualified, but we'll put you on the list. And if an opening comes up, we'll call you. When I saw that, I said, okay, I'm going to check out the B-58. And that's when I applied and was accepted and went to the B-58. And I kept calling this buddy of mine after I was aggressive in the B-58. I said, "Daryl, get your paperwork in. This is the airplane." And his response always was, "Blackbird or nothing." And I said, "Okay, stupid, it's going to be nothing. You're going to spend the rest of your life in that damn buff." Well, then about a year or two later, I get a call from him.
Mm-hmm.
"Hey, Yuma, I got some orders to BO Air Force Base." And I said, "Oh, you're going to be tanker support for the SR, huh?" And he said, "Says SR-71. Anyway, he got it. And then he would call me and he'd say, Mach 2, yeah, we're just getting up on the step at Mach 2.
Oh,
so, that was another story that was kind of similar to the one about the 111.
Now, who were they taking for SR-71 at that point? Do you know what the profile was?
No, I don't, and really because there were so few slots. Daryl told me, because I asked him, I said, "How in the hell did you ever get that anyway?" And he said, "Willie Sontag." Willie Sontag was a SAC CEG, Combat Evaluation Group guy.
Okay.
Who evidently, and there was there were a couple of SAC generals that felt that there should be more B-52 types, or at least a B-52 type in the SR-71 program. And he said that guy really kind of made it happen. And I don't know if that meant they didn't have any B-52 people in the program. Could have been. There may not have been any. But I know where most of them came from.
Mm-hmm.
The story about the initial cadre for the 111 were primarily B-58 people.
Yes.
Well, the same is true for the SR-71. Most of the SR-71 people came out of the B-58 program when they initially started it.
Now, do you think that has to do with the pilot's accomplishments in a B-58?
It has to do with the airplane.
Uh-huh.
I'm sure they looked and said, "Hey, you know, where are we going to go for pilots to fly this SR-71, for pilots to fly the 111? And the SR-71, my assumption would be, and particularly since the SR-71 was a SAC resource, that was a SAC airplane.
Right.
So they're looking within the command, and they're saying, "Well, do we have any pilots that would be adaptable to the SR-71? And that would have been a no-brainer. They'd look around and say, "What airplanes do we have in the inventory?" "Oh, here's a B-58, single-pilot airplane, high-speed, high-performing airplane." That's the logical match. And so that's why they went for the SR. In the 111, there, I'm sure the reason was that the 111 was so similar to the B-58. It was a medium bomber, not a heavy bomber, medium bomber.
Mm-hmm.
Again, single-pilot airplane. And kind of the same mission and everything else, and also built by the same company. So there was a logical tie-in there, too.
Okay. It's sort of like buying a Ford. You just keep buying a Ford.
Yeah,
because
yeah,
you know where all
yeah.
the bits are. And,
yeah,
right?
Yeah. You
okay.
got it.
That's extremely interesting about the SR-71. I just want to ask, John, did you ever have a chance to fly one?
Never did.
No?
Never did. I wish I would have. And I told my buddy, I said, I sure wouldn't want to do this as a job, because those guys were in those spacesuits. They had to go down and pre-breathe and all that trash. And when they landed at a strange base, man, it was quite an involved process. But I sure would have loved to have flown that bird one time.
How long a field did they have to have before
they didn't need any more runway than we did.
Really? And that was how long?
Oh, about, we usually operated off of runways 12,000, 13,000 feet. In fact, all the runways that the Blackbird operated off of were similar.
So there was no special requirement there?
No, runway length. There was a requirement. I have no idea how much runway they needed, but I'm sure it was a fair amount, just like the 58. The 58 required a lot of runway.
Yes, right.
So I'm sure that one did, too. See, that was the advantage of the 111. It didn't require nearly the runway because of that swing wing capability.
Oh, okay. And how did that affect speed? Did that slow it down, did you say, when you put the whole wing out?
Yes, that's right. As you extend the wing and make it more straight, if you will, perpendicular to the fuselage, then that allows you to fly slow. When you sweep the wings, then it looks like a B-58.
Mm-hmm.
Then the wings are back and you can go fast.
And what's slow for the F-111? Just
I don't know what their loiter speed would have been. I would have guessed, I know they came down final at about 160 knots, where we came down final at about 200 knots, and they probably could loiter 200, 250. Whereas for us, 250 was as slow as we flew in the traffic pattern.
In the B-58?
In the 58, mm-hmm. Yeah.
But you did get to keep flying your favorite aircraft, right, when you went to Indiana?
That's what I flew there. That's
yeah.
correct. When I went there, I was going to the B-58 wing up there in Indiana, and I flew it until they put it in the boneyard.
And the B-58, what was the mission there at Grissom for what squadron you were with?
It was a bombing mission. In other words, we pulled alert,
mm-hmm.
and we were targeted against targets in Russia.
And do you remember, were you there actually when the 1967 Middle East conflict flared up? Or was that
yeah.
after?
Well, no. Yes, I was. I was there in 67, but yeah. it didn't affect us.
It did not?
No.
Okay.
No, we used to, the only deployment we ever did was just, and it was a practice thing, in case we had to deploy, we would go, like I remember I went on a deployment to Spain, but we were only over there for about a week, and it was just to get you used to operating out of a strange field.
Oh, sure.
Yeah, mm-hmm. yeah, but that was it. And primarily, the mission really was just like the B-52 mission, exactly. We pulled alert. We flew training missions. And our job on alert when we were pulling alert was to strike targets in Russia, just like in the B-52.
Were the targets different, though?
No, they were similar. I don't think there was much difference in the target packages for the
okay.
58s versus the B-52.
And what kind of weapons would you have been carrying? Do you know anything about that?
Yeah, five nuclear weapons. We had four on the wings, external, and then the big one in that pod that was underneath the airplane.
What was the configuration, if you can say, of those guys hanging on the wings? The weapons that were hanging on the wings.
What do you mean?
Well, were they? How big were they?
They weren't
just the
that
dimensions.
Large because
okay.
to fit on external stores, they just couldn't be that big. They were fairly small nukes.
Uh-huh.
But you know, and that small nuke.
Yeah.
If you get my drift.
I sure do.
Yeah.
And the big guy inside, that was just to fall freely out of the aircraft?
Yeah, which is the same way that the ones under the wing were. So we didn't have any guided munitions.
Okay.
Ours were just the old radar synchronous bombing.
Mm-hmm. Did you ever feel nervous having those loaded on the plane?
Yeah, primarily when we'd have what they called a COCO exercise.
Okay.
And that would be when the klaxon blew, and the COCO, as compared to a Bravo, a COCO meant you taxi. You taxied the airplanes out of the alert area, taxied them out to the end of the runway, and then simulated takeoff. You'd light the afterburners and start down the runway, and then you'd just taxi off.
Mm-hmm.
And particularly in the wintertime up there in Indiana, if you had some ice on the runway,
mm-hmm.
It could get a little dicey, particularly when everybody's trying to get out of those hustler huts as fast as you can, because the thing was all speed. It was how quick could those airplanes be on the runway after that klaxon sounded.
Sure.
So everybody was rushing, and so it got a little exciting sometimes, particularly, like I say, if you got some weather.
Mm-hmm.
If you had some snow and ice on the taxiways, if it was night, it could get kind of exciting. In fact, they lost one B-58 there. It was before I got there, but they had a guy that Tower had given them the wrong runway. They'd told them one runway was the active, and it was actually the other one. And the guy turned around and went back to the correct runway. As he was turning to simulate takeoff,
mm-hmm.
he hit a patch of ice. Airplane slid off the taxiway and burned up with the nuclear weapons on board, as it turned out. I don't even remember if there were any fatalities. I think there were a couple people that died in that.
Would it have been the pilot?
No, I know the pilot didn't, Larry Johnson. This is so typical of the Air Force. Guy ends up as, guess what his job was after that little event?
I don't know, chief of staff? I don't know. I'm just guessing.
You are so close.
Am I?
Chief of safety.
Really?
Chief of safety. And this guy, he had a reputation of being wanting to be first all the time, so he was probably really humming down that taxiway, and when he tried to do a 180 to get on the active runway and hit that patch of ice, you can see why he kind of lost it. But, yeah, that used to be kind of exciting. Of course, the other exciting thing about pulling alert, and this is no the same thing. What I just told you is the same in the B-52. It's
mm-hmm.
exactly the same deal in the B-52.
That exercise.
Yeah, that mm-hmm. exercise at COCO, and the same thing. When you taxied at night with that B-52 fully loaded, because that B-52 is kind of like a 18-wheeler. You know, when they get moving, it's not so easy to stop them. The 58 was a little easier to stop because it was a much smaller airplane, but that 52 fully loaded, when it got rolling, if something popped, if another airplane popped right out in front of you, kind of hard to get stopped.
I guess.
But never, all the time I was in B-52, I never, fortunately, never had a taxi accident with the nukes on board. The other thing that was always a concern was that klaxon every time it blew. You know, you assumed every time it was a practice, but you never knew. Until you got in the airplane and got your radios on, you didn't know if it was practice or if it was a real thing until you got the message over the radio.
That's wild.
Yeah, and so you never knew. In fact, I never got one, obviously never mm-hmm. got one to launch to go to war, but we did. There was an intermediate message you could get that would tell you to taxi out to the end of the runway and keep your engines running, which was a high, high state of alert. It's kind of like the deal with the Homeland Security now, where they've got the green and the mm-hmm. orange and the red and mm-hmm. all those color-coded things about the state of alert.
Right.
And it was the same thing in SAC at that time with the alert aircraft.
Did you ever have one of those that was that higher
yes,
threshold?
Yes, in fact, that's what I was going to tell you about.
Sure.
And we had a real good indication that this was not a practice because the klaxon went off about 4 o'clock in the morning. And that never happened. That was the only time I've ever heard a klaxon go off that early in the morning. About 4 o'clock in the morning, horn blows, and we run out the airplane and get on there, and it's a blue dot. Now, all the training missions were always green dots, and this was a blue dot. So, boy, everybody is really paying attention. And that was pretty exciting. I mean, you're sitting out there with the engines running, and you're kind of expecting the next message to be launch. And, we had no idea what precipitated it.
Right.
And the other clue that maybe if I'd thought about time, but most of us didn't, we just thought, my God, it's happened, we're on our way, was the other thing that should have been a clue to us that might not be going was that there hadn't been anything in the news. Like, you're too young, but with the Cuban crisis,
right.
we had a clue that something was in the air there
yes.
because we'd been reading about it in the paper, you know, all
absolutely.
The stuff that was going on down there. And then the blockade and all that. So when we were told to that we were going to be flying a lot of airborne alert, that was no surprise to us because we had seen it building up. But with this thing, there was nothing in the news, nothing else. But
uh-huh.
what it turned out to be, we found out later, was it was a combination of they think, they don't know for sure, but they had some power outages on the BMUs line up in Alaska and north of there where they had those radar sites.
Oh, sure.
And they had some power outages which were unexplained. And also, I guess they had some flocks of geese flying. And between the two, they thought they might have seen inbound aircraft. And so that's what put us at the end of the runway.
Can you venture a guess as to sort of what time frame this was?
This would have been probably, I would guess, mid-60s, like 65, 64, 65.
So this was while you were at Altus then?
Yeah.
Okay. Wow. That's chilling.
Yeah. The most chilling thing of all, Laura,
uh-huh.
and I've told this so many times, and it ties in with the Cuban crisis.
Sure.
I've told people, I think the most frightened I ever was flying was the thing I'm about to tell you, even more so than my shoot down and everything else,
mm-hmm.
Because I will never forget it as long as I live. It was at the height of the Cuban crisis. In fact, what I was just telling you is when they put us into this airborne airborne alert posture, and that is where you take off with the nuclear weapons aboard and fly these predetermined routes. Ours was flying to Spain. We were refueling over Spain, and, of course, the purpose of that route was to get you closer to Russia in case they decide to send you, that you're that much closer to your target.
Right.
Well, They had just launched ourselves and one other airplane on this airborne alert mission, and it was at the time when the Russian ships were headed for the blockade, and nobody knew whether they were going to try to break through the line or whether they'd stop and let us inspect them.
Right.
And it was about, we were on our way to Spain. It was about 2 o'clock in the morning, and I was a co-pilot at the time. My pilot was back trying to get a little sleep before we hit the tankers, and I'm sitting there. Well, of course, we're listening to the radio, waiting for a message, and all at once, we're about 2 hours out of Spain, and all at once I see, it's a real dark night, all at once I see the sky starting to light up out in the middle of me at 2 o'clock in the morning. And I thought, oh, my God, they've hit our bases in Spain. Those are the nuclear weapons detonating. And I called the guy on the other airplane, and I said, hey, you see what I see out in front? And he said, I sure do. And I said, have you heard anything on the radio? And he said, no. But I couldn't think of anything else that it could be other than just nuclear explosion. And about that time, had an undercast. And about that time, a full moon breaks through the undercast. And I was never so relieved in my life to see a moon as I was when that moon broke through that undercast. But that's what was lighting the sky up out in front of me, was that moon before it came through the clouds. And I just knew that that was the beginning of World War III. And by the way, Laura, my opinion on World War III always was that if it ever kicked off, that was it. The ball game was over. And I can tie that in to the POW experience in that going through survival school, that's dead, and to prepare you for being shot down and captured.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And I went through with the worst possible attitude, like, I'm not going to pay attention to this stuff because what difference does it make? And that was my opinion, was if we in SAC ever go to war, it's going to be all over anyway. So I didn't care about survival. But as things turned out in my life, when I was sitting in jail up in Hanoi, then I thought, probably would have behooved me to pay a little more attention to that survival school they sent me to back there in the early 60s. So,
and have you sort of passed on that,
I have.
Hard-earned wisdom?
Yes, particularly when I talk to military groups.
Yes.
When I talk to the younger...
I'll bet they pay attention too, John. I would.
Well, and
I am.
Yeah, you're right, Lori. It's fit in beautifully because I've been able to tell them. I said, now look, guys, don't have the attitude I had when I went to survival school, and then I tell them the story.
But in some way you were justified because as a strategic air command pilot, you were in a totally different environment than
that's
when you
exactly
were flying.
Right. I had no clue.
Over Vietnam. Yeah,
yeah, I this was way before Vietnam.
Sure.
I didn't see a Vietnam coming. So.
Well, how was life at Grissom? Did you, in addition to all of these duties, manage to have a good time, and your family's growing, and was it a good place to live?
Oh, yeah, it was great because I was 60 miles from my hometown.
That's right. I've forgotten. You're right.
Yeah, so I got to spend a lot of time with my parents that probably I wouldn't have had otherwise. In fact, I know I did. And while I was there, my father died, so I was right there in the area when he died, which was a good thing. But good times, yeah, there were some real good times. And in fact, Laura, since you asked,
mm-hmm.
I just happen to have a couple of war stories.
Okay, great.
About the good times.
Great.
The first one was my DSO, Defensive Systems Operator,
mm-hmm.
and my navigator. Those were the two people that were in the airplane with me all the time.
In the 58.
In the 58, mm-hmm. my group. And I had a real strong desire to see what that B-58 flew like upside down. But it was prohibited by SAC.
Absolutely.
And my navigator was kind of a straight-laced guy, but my DSO had the same desire that I had. He wanted to see what it was like upside down, too. And I told him, I said, okay, Larry, I said, here's the deal. Anytime you can talk Fast Eddie into going upside down, I'll do it, but I'm not going to do it until he buys off because I don't want to end my flying career now. And so he was working. He would work on him, and Eddie would never agree. And finally, one day we were up in northern Michigan, and he's making practice bomb runs, and he's having a great day. And Larry, the DSO, seeing his opportunity, says, "Hey, Eddie, come on, let's try it. Let's let the driver get this thing upside down." So Eddie starts weakening, and he finally says, "Well, okay, but, you know, just don't spend too much time upside down." Okay, so we're coming, we're just at the northern end of Lake Michigan, coming back, beautiful day like today, and so I say, "Okay, guys, here we go." So I roll the airplane, everything is beautiful, and get it back right side up, and Larry says, "Man, that was great," he said, "but do you think you could just get it inverted and keep it inverted for a while?" And I said, "Sure, no problem." So I did, and we're enjoying the view, inverted, when I just happened to glance at the Mach meter, and it was sitting at about 0.98, and my whole life passed in front of me, and I thought, "Oh, my God, I cannot believe this." I got that airplane back right side up and slowed as quickly as I could. And for the next two or three days, every time the phone would ring, I'd make Rose answer it because I just knew it was a call saying, "Let's talk about your mission a couple of days ago when you were coming down Lake Michigan, pointed straight at Chicago. And we've gotten reports of windows broken and things happening in Chicago, and they're thinking it might have been a sonic boom. What do you know about that, Ewell?" That was my fear. I thought, "Oh, my God, I boomed Chicago," because we were right off, just below the Mach, and I was at the perfect altitude to do the most damage with a sonic boom, about 20,000 feet, and I just knew that I had ended my flying career there.
You were close.
I was,
in other words,
oh,
you were way close.
So close. I was terrified. Just, I barely was able to fly that airplane back and land it. I just knew I had bought the farm, theoretically speaking. I mean, I just...
I know.
I saw my wings flying out of the cockpit.
Right, you're never going to fly again.
That's right, yeah. So, and that was another thing about the B-58, since we only had a few of those airplanes, and there was only, you know, maybe two or three flying at the same time. It wouldn't take any mental giant to figure out who the pilot was in an airplane, any event that occurred, which leads me to the next story.
Okay.
60 miles from my hometown, right?
Right.
Now, what could happen here? I mean, if I'm 60 miles away from my hometown, I probably ought to go pay them a visit in my go-fast airplane.
Just kind of roll by one day.
Yeah, so.
Sure.
And this gets a little involved, but this
That's
was
all right.
This was the good old days, Laura, when you could do stuff like this. Mm-hmm. It took a little bit of planning. For example, this the first time I'm coming back. We're coming from the south back up toward Grissom, and about over Indianapolis, I call Indianapolis Center, and I say, "Okay, Center, canceling my IFR." Again, it was a day like today. Some things had to happen. In SAC, if you were scheduled for an 8-hour mission, they expected you to fly 8 hours. Well, a lot of times, if everything went just as planned, you'd get back and you'd have 20 or 30 minutes back in the local area before your time was up. And usually you use that shooting a couple of landings, practicing a couple of approaches.
Okay.
But always in the back of my head was, one of these days, when I come back, if it's a beautiful day, if I have enough fuel, and if I have some time, I'm going to go visit Boswell, Indiana. And so this was the day. And so I canceled my instrument flying rules, which means now Center doesn't track you anymore. They don't control you. You're on your own. And so I canceled IFR, go VFR, and turned my IFF off so they can't track me, and go to visit Boswell. And so I do now back to my two crew members again. Remember the
same
story?
Guys.
Yeah, same two guys.
Okay.
Remember the story about going inverted? Well, we've got the same problem now on going to visit my hometown.
Eddie wasn't going to be doing this happily.
Eddie is not real excited about it, but he's okay with it, but he's not excited about it.
Okay.
But as I'm dropping down to get a good look at my hometown and so they can get a good look at me, he is calling off the altitude as we're descending, and his voice is rising as he goes, 500 feet, 400 feet, and Larry, my DSO, is saying, well, God dang it, if we're going to come over here, we'll at least get down low enough so they can see us. You know, he's pushing me down, and Eddie's trying to keep me up. At any rate, we make a couple of low passes over Boswell, and relatives that live about 10 miles out of the town, and I knew this because there was just a church out there, so I ID'd the church, and
right.
I knew that their house was just a couple of houses down. So I made a couple passes over their house, and boy, when I got back home that day, the phone was ringing. I was getting lots of calls from people in Boswell that had seen me fly over in my Go Fast airplane. So I did that a couple of times, and then the final chapter in this story comes. Let's see, this is 05. In 02, we had our 50th anniversary of my high school class.
Oh, sure, uh-huh.
And the school has long since closed through consolidation in this little town of Boswell, but they have an alumni banquet every year, and it's for anybody that's graduated from good old Boswell High School. And they recognize the 50-year class, the 25-year class, and so on and so forth. Well, 3 years ago when it was our 50th, I was the spokesperson for our class. And one of the things I said to the assembled group was, I said, I am willing to bet that I have seen Boswell, Indiana from a vantage point that no one else has. And I said, how many of you have seen Boswell from 200 feet at about 500 miles an hour? And, of course, no one has. So that's the final chapter in that story. So, yeah, I had some good times.
It sounds like a blast. Yeah. But those people on the ground must have just, I mean, I haven't been 200 feet away from a B-58, but I've been maybe 600 feet below a flyover at a stadium or something like that. That's one I remember particularly at Michigan Stadium, and I just couldn't believe the feel of that as it goes by.
I'm sure they could feel the vibrations from the noise.
Unbelievable.
Yeah. And of course, it depends upon who you talk to, you know. My parents were saying, boy, you seem to be awfully low. And, of course, my buddies were saying, whoa, wow.
Cool.
How do I get a ride in that airplane?
Now, did Eddie kind of lighten up a little as time went on? Or?
Yeah, Eddie did. It was a getting comfortable with the airplane, getting comfortable with maybe me, he was more adventuresome at the end.
Let me ask a little bit about the dynamics between the pilot and the two support guys on the B-58. In general, did they put you together and you had to stay together regardless?
That was Sachs' way of doing it, which I thought was a pretty good idea.
Yeah.
You really got, it's kind of like, you know, you can use the analogy of a sports team. You know, Bobby Knight and his Texas Tech Raiders. But anyway, you read a lot and you hear a lot about the chemistry of a team.
Sure.
You know, and it's true. There is something about the chemistry that exists. And if you've got a good team, if you are three people, in this case in B-58, if you're three people that get along well, that work well together, there is an advantage to flying with those same people all the time, because you get to know, you have a sense of what the other person's doing, what they're going to be doing, how they perform, and that's the good news. There's, like everything else in life, there's a bad side to that, too, and it gets to be where you count on that person to do what they've done all along,
right.
And if they don't, then you can be in trouble.
Right.
But overall, I always thought it was a good idea, and so, yes, the philosophy in SAC was that you would be an integral crew, that they'd try as best they could to keep you together as a crew and try to limit the number of crew changes. And I know when I first went into SAC in 1960,
right,
the crew I went on, We didn't have a crew change for 4 years.
And that's just remarkable.
Yeah, all of us, that is remarkable. And that changed as the dynamics of the personnel when they started having more problems. Well, as Vietnam cranked up, people were being pulled off to go to Vietnam, and there was just more flux in the crew crew field that they just couldn't keep crews together that long at the end.
And that was true inside SAC.
That's within SAC, okay. Yeah. In fact, one of the big problems was in MAC, the Military Airlift Command. They ended up with a SAC 4-star general that tried to run MAC like SAC, and he was going with this integrated crew thing, and man, they did not like that at all. It really didn't make as much sense there because crew coordination wasn't as big a thing. If you're trash hauling, you don't need the crew coordination as much as you do if you're bombing. So I think it made more sense from a SAC standpoint than it would from some other commands.
John, this is a question that sort of reads our history a little bit backwards, but I just thought I'd throw it in. Were there any, as you were working in SAC from 60 all the way on, did you come across African-American or Hispanic pilots and crew members in the B-58 program?
Well, 60 to 66 when I was in the buffs, that's an interesting question, Laura. Let me think. There were very few. One, I know there was an EW who was like a DSO in the B-58. In the B-52, we called them EWs, electronic warfare officers.
Right.
And one was a black who I knew very well. I've got some more stories for you on that.
I think you mentioned him earlier.
Yeah.
What was his name?
Harold Bodweed.
Yeah, I think you told me a little bit about him.
Right. Yeah, I probably told you about... God, I'm having a blank on the name of the guy I went through pilot training with.
Yes, the
motel deal, breakfast.
Exactly.
Yeah. That was, what the heck was his name? Anyway, but that was a different deal, yeah. And I probably told you about Bodweed. I'm sure I told you about because we hooked up out of Castle when we were going through training together, when we both came into SAC, and that was a refueling experience I had
right. Where
I was all over the place. But anyway, then there was, we had a couple of, Spanish-American guys. One was he was also an EW, by the way.
Uh-huh.
And but other than that, there just weren't very many.
Did you at
Altus.
Okay. And of course, you're becoming more and more of a senior pilot, but could you see younger guys coming in who were members of minorities?
Not that I recall.
Really?
No. I do not. You know, that's interesting. I'd never thought about that before, but now that you bring it up and I think about it, it is kind of unusual that we didn't have more minorities in that wing. I think it's unusual because I know they were in the military by then, in the 60s.
Right, and all over the Air Force, too.
Yeah,
but
yeah.
I wonder what the reasons for that were. I'm sure they're complicated.
Yeah, I don't know. And in 58, I remember we had three black pilots, of which two were really good and one was just absolutely terrible. He was just really bad. And we had a few black crew members. In fact, one of my best friends was a navigator. He was a big tennis buddy. He and I used to play tennis together all the time.
He was an African American guy.
Yeah.
Do you
remember
his name?
Yeah, I sure do. Walt Ray. And this guy, you talk about an interesting person. He went to high school with Johnny Mathis.
No kidding. Huh.
Classmate of Mathis.
Uh-huh.
And he used to entertain sometimes at our parties. He would sing, and he was a good singer, but he told me about, he primarily said with Mathis, they were in athletics together, because
right.
This guy was a big jock, and but he told me one thing I never forgot. He said Mathis was interested in singing even then in high school, and he said, I told him once, I said, Mathis, forget it. He said, you're never going to make it as a singer. You sound like a girl. And so the rest is history.
That's right.
But
that's
funny. He told me about what a great athlete Mathis was. He was really good.
Wow.
And, At any rate, this guy and I got to be very good friends. And
this is while you were at Altus?
No, this was at Grissom B-58. Uh-huh. He was a navigator.
Oh.
He was never on my crew, but but we used to go down to Indianapolis for the National Clay Court Tournament every year.
Sure.
We just did a lot of stuff together. Primarily, the primary thing was the tennis. But, yeah, we had a few. I guess on a ratio basis, there were a few more at Grissom in the 58s. Now, it might have just been that there were more and more minorities coming into the military by that time.
Mm-hmm.
And that might have been why. But
did he or any of your buddies display any reaction or upset during that time that you were at Grissom when Martin Luther King was assassinated?
Not that I recall.
Do you remember that happening?
Yes, John? I do remember that happening, and I don't remember. The one I would have been really focused on would have been Walt, and I don't remember anything out of the ordinary that he had to say. But along that line, the only one that I ever knew that really had a problem with the racial thing was Harold Bodweed, the EW back at Altus.
Right.
And with, I'm sure, a lot of good justification. He had some interesting stories to tell.
Oh, sure.
But he really had a chip on his shoulder. I mean, and he was really not very well liked in the wing because of his attitude.
Mm-hmm.
I really got along with him well. I enjoyed him but I knew him better than most of the other people. We were next door neighbors, and we got to be very good friends. But that he did have an attitude, and I think it was primarily because of things that had happened to him earlier. He was an Annapolis graduate, and he had just gone through some things that were pretty demeaning and bothered
imagine.
Him a lot.
Mm-hmm. How do you spell his last name? Do you remember, John?
Baudit.
Okay.
He's dead now.
Is he?
Yeah. And Marty, his wife, we lost track of her. I don't know if she's still around or not.
Huh. Well, we should look into it. Maybe we could include her and be very very honored to do that and see if we can't get something of his experiences recorded.
Mm-hmm.
Now, John, you're flying the B-58s, and you know that they're going out of style,
mm-hmm.
and they're going to be replaced.
Right.
How did you feel about that? You knew that transition was coming up, and how would it affect you? Did you kind of think about those things?
Yeah, the first thing is, really didn't know we kind of got blindsided by this thing.
Okay.
There was no advance warning that it was going to happen, although there had been the normal conversation that, hey, you know, we're in a limited production airplane that has been out of production now for about 4 or 5 years, and we're nuclear capable only. We don't have conventional capability. And by this time, of course, we've been in Vietnam for 4 or 5 years.
Right.
So if you just start looking around and looking at the big picture, we had a concern that we might be on the chopping block because our mission was so limited, our airplane was out of production. And as it turned out, that's exactly why the airplane was taken out of service, was because of the limited number and the high cost of operating the airplane since it was out of production. And it was a financial decision that SAC made. And they came forward with two proposals, either scrap the B-58s or they'd have to scrap about half the B-52s. Well, at that time, they were using the B-52s in Vietnam. So DOD said, well, you know, we'll just scrap the 58 because the B-52s were using in Vietnam, and they can carry dumb bombs. They can carry the just iron bombs, which is what we're using over there. So that was what brought about the demise, but really didn't think about it until just one day we found out that they're going to scrap the B-58s, and then all of us knew we were on our way to Vietnam because we had been exempt from Vietnam as long as we were in the 58. We knew we weren't going to go to Vietnam, and so none of us had been to Vietnam, and so when the airplane went in the boneyard, all of us, we knew we were on our way to Vietnam. So I certainly wasn't happy about that because I had just upgraded to what they called CCTS, Combat Crew Training Squadron,
mm-hmm.
and that's the squadron that checks out the new guys coming into the program.
Okay.
And I had just gone to that squadron as a new instructor pilot. And so one of the many nice things about being an instructor pilot, particularly in CCTS, you had instructor pilots that were just squadron instructor pilots. But if you were a CCTS instructor pilot, which I was, in that training squadron in the schoolhouse, then you didn't have to pull nearly as much alert because you were flying most of the time with your students. So,
okay, so your hours were already being...
Yeah, so I was all excited about that, and I had just upgraded to instructor pilot and gone to CCTS just months before finding out the airplane was going to go in the boneyard. So I had my whole career staked out. I was just going to stay there, stay in CCTS until my 20 years was up, and then I was getting out, and I had it all planned. So the abrupt ending to my plan was when they decided to put them in the boneyard and then realized I was going to Vietnam, because I knew as long as I was in the program, I was exempt from Vietnam.
Right.
I had no desire to go to Vietnam, as compared to a lot of my peers. A lot of my peers were not upset at all about this happening because for career progression, it really helps to have a war while you're being evaluated. If you're in combat, that helps your chances of progressing within the military. And so a lot of them saw this as a great opportunity. And also a lot of them said, this is where the action is. This is where I want to be.
So some guys felt like flying the B-58s was sort of being in a cul-de-sac that they weren't going to be able to get out of.
Yeah, yeah.
And this development, the SAC cancellation.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
And when did that actually happen? Was that 69 or?
It was actually January of 70.
Okay. Wow.
The last alert tour, I was out on alert, and it was a short week because 31st of December at midnight, we shut down the alert facility, and we got to go home early.
That must have been a strange
That was a strange deal to be on alert for the final alert tour of the B-58, and then 2 or 3 weeks later, I was flying one out to Tucson to put it in the boneyard.
Yeah, that must have been really sad.
Yeah, it was. It was. Yeah. I just thought, what is wrong with this picture?
Yeah.
Putting this airplane in the boneyard and knowing that B-52 is still flying.
Right.
And it's still flying.
And it's still flying, yeah. What aircraft, if you can say, John, took up the duties that the B-58 had been doing, like what you had been doing out of Grissom?
The 111.
So everything got picked up by the 111 right away.
Right.
And did they have a good inventory of 111s by then?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yeah, they were fully operational.
And
not fully operational, but they were coming online, so there was no problem there.
Okay. So they'd been in production for probably a couple, three years by then.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So when did you find out what your next beat was going to be? Do you remember?
No, it would have been probably, I would have guessed late January probably is when the assignments came down. And we found out where we were going in Vietnam.
And
we covered the whole waterfront. I mean, we went to every airplane that they had in country. And so we had people going to everything. Of course, that's when I went over there in 130s.
And you were you sent to Guam first or directly to Tanzanite?
No, I went to, I was actually stationed at in Taiwan.
Oh,
at a base called
CCK,
mm-hmm. just about 90 miles south of Taipei
in
Taiwan. That's where we were stationed. But when we operated mostly out of Tanzanite in Saigon.
And you were this was the first time, really, that you'd flown the C-130s?
Mm-hmm.
What'd you think of this aircraft, John?
Oh.
tell me the truth.
Two things.
Uh-huh.
One is I went from the most beautiful airplane to the ugliest airplane in one giant step. It has got a severe case of the uglies. But the other thing is, it's without a doubt the easiest airplane to fly that I've ever flown in my life. That airplane was so easy to fly, it was ridiculous. So And I will have to say that it was kind of like I was forced to say about the B-52.
Mm-hmm.
And all the bad-mouthing I did of the B-52, I had to admit it had some good points, and kind of the same way with the 130. Highly reliable airplane. Never had hardly any problems with the airplane, and I was flying in and out of dirt strips, really bad places, and the airplane was just very, very reliable. And so, but the thing I remember specifically was the first approach I made in the airplane, and I thought from the time I got lined up with the runway on final, I thought I would never get to the end of the runway. It just seemed to take forever to get to the end of the runway because we're flying so slow. Coming out of that airplane, coming out of the B-58, which when you turn final, the next, you blink your eye and you're over the runway. And now in this 130, you just sit there and drive and drive and drive before you get to the end of the runway.
What was the sort of general speed, top speed of a
Probably 130? In the B-58, we were usually about 210, 220 knots on final.
Mm-hmm.
The 130 was about 130 knots.
Wow.
So about 70 to 80 knots difference in speed.
Oh, my gosh. Yeah, that's a big difference.
Yeah, that is. You kind of think about it, put it in terms of automobiles. If you're out on the interstate driving 30 or if you're driving, 110 or something, that's kind of the difference.
So you had a lot of reaction time.
Oh, yeah, you had so much time.
Maybe too much, huh?
You could take a nap coming down final.
What was the crew structure like on the 130s?
Okay, you had, of course, now you're back pilot and co-pilot, and you've got a navigator. You've got a loadmaster, and he's the guy that is just as the name implies. He's responsible for loading the airplane,
mm-hmm.
making sure the load's loaded properly and all that good stuff. And then you had a flight engineer. And he was the most important guy on the airplane for me because I had limited knowledge of that airplane. And these flight engineers usually had been in the airplane for years and years. And they're the ones that were there to help you with all the systems in the airplane and everything else.
And probably also tell you what it can do, what it can't do.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
What this is within the parameters. Go ahead and do it.
Yeah. That was the guy that I really relied on heavily in that airplane.
Okay, John, let's take a break.